The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Well, good evening, and welcome to this evening's Milia Gordon Memorial Lecture at the Free Library. My name is Andy Cahan. I'm the Director of Author Events here. As you may know, the Free Library is currently working hard to match a very generous $15 million anonymous challenge gift to the Central Library's expansion project, an endeavor which will not only bring you increased comfort in a new state-of-the-art auditorium, which will be wonderful, but will also provide all members of the Philadelphia community a much-needed creative and cutting-edge information center that is free and accessible to everyone. All private gifts made to the Central Library Expansion Project through May 31st will be matched dollar for dollar. So if there was ever a time to give, that time is now. And before I introduce this evening's speaker, as usual, if you turn off your cell phones, things of that nature. A foreign correspondent who has reported from more than 140 countries, Robin Wright covers U.S. foreign policy for the Washington Post. Her foreign tours include 5 years in the Middle East, 2 years in Europe, 7 years in Africa, and many additional years as a roving reporter in these areas, as well as Latin America and Asia. A MacArthur Foundation grant recipient, she is the author of 3 previous books focused on modern Islam and contemporary Iranian politics. When you open Sunday's New York Times book review, you'll notice that the cover is devoted to Robin Wright's latest offering, Dreams and Shadows. The reviewer, Patrick Coburn of The Independent of London, states, Wright has long been one of the best-informed American journalists covering the Middle East, and her reputation is borne out here. She is refreshingly skeptical of conventional wisdom about what is happening in the region, and her book will be essential reading for anybody who wants to know where it is heading. Please welcome Robin Wright.
I'm delighted to be with you on this cold night, and I'm honored that so many of you showed up. I'm not sure I would have myself. On a warm spring day in 1983, I stood in front of what had been the U.S. Embassy in Beirut. A few hours earlier, it had been bombed by what was the very first suicide bomber against an American target anywhere. For hours, rescuers went through tons of mangled concrete and steel, looking for bits of bodies, which they put in small blue plastic bags, hoping to match up later so the bodies could be buried together. Some of the dead had been my friends, and so this was a loss I felt both as an American and as someone who knew those who'd worked in that building. Over the next 18 months, I heard other bombings at a second U.S. embassy and at the Marine compound, which was the largest single loss of U.S. life in a single incident since World War II. There is no attack in Iraq or Afghanistan or Vietnam that ever equaled what happened in Beirut. Those 3 terrorism spectaculars marked the beginning of what was a new trend in the region, a turning point. And out of my own anguish over what happened, I decided to try to look into where these people came from and what they wanted and who they were. Over the next 5 years, I went to Iran to track down the revolutionaries and the militants. Over the next decade, I went to Afghanistan during the days the Taliban ruled there, the days Osama bin Laden had set up camps there. Over that period, Islamic extremism grew into what is today the most serious threat to American interests in the Middle East, the biggest threat, in fact, to Western powers anyplace. It's a new form of sacred rage that has redefined the world's political spectrum. Its explosive potential will continue to be the primary cause of national anxiety and national security concerns for decades to come as Al-Qaeda and its allies push deeper into the region and beyond. But that's not what I came to talk to you about tonight. I've discovered what I think is the beginning, and I stress the beginning, of something different, something new. I think that a generation later, the Islamic extremists are no longer the most dynamic, the most interesting, or the most important force in the Middle East. The hardcore extremists of Al-Qaeda or Islamic Jihad will still try to destroy. The bombings are not over, and that is the problem. But there is today also some promise in the Middle East. Some 25 years later, after those first attacks, there's a growing recognition throughout the Middle East that the extremists have not provided a single solution or any viable model to answer the problems of everyday life for most of the people in the region. In the early 21st century, there is the beginning, the budding of a culture of change that is instead imaginatively challenging the status quo across some two dozen countries. They are even challenging the extremists. I spent over a year wandering through the region again after the so-called Arab Spring of 2005, trying to get a sense of how serious this was. Was this a flash in the pan? Was this something that had enduring potential? I went back to the places where I'd lived and traveled since 1973. In fact, I landed for the first time in the Middle East on October 6, 1973, which was the day the war broke out. I have an uncanny ability to do that. My father once said he wouldn't go on vacation with me to Bermuda because he was sure there'd be a revolution. I've covered a dozen wars and several revolutions, and I can go to the most peaceful places and something happens. I am by nature, I will tell you, a pessimist. You know, some people talk about the glass half full, others talk about it half empty. I'm the one who says, is there really water in the glass? So you have to understand that for me to come to any kind of positive conclusion, to begin to see any sign of hope, is really surprising to me most of all. What I found during the year of going back and wandering through the region in 2006 and 2007 were new public voices and daring publications and increasingly noisy protests that were giving shape to a new diverse, often disjointed trend. It includes defiant judges in Cairo and rebel clerics in Tehran, satellite station owners in Dubai, imaginative feminists in Rabat, and the first female political candidates in Kuwait. It includes young techies in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, daring journalists in Beirut and Casablanca, and brave businessmen in Damascus. For all of them, peaceful empowerment has become the preferred means of pursuing their goals, looking for ways to have a say in their future. The tiny minority willing to go out and kill has had such impact in part because there were so few political alternatives out there. That's no longer true. Today, because of impatience and frustration fueled by education, the miracles of instant media, demographics, and change elsewhere in the world that is now accessible, visible to those who live in the region, have altered the political dynamics. For years, we talked about the Mujahideen holy warriors and the roadside and battlefield bombs they used to challenge the things that were near and dear to us. And when I went to the region, I used to go look for the Mujahideen, the clandestine cells, as the barometer of opposition. Today, I go out and I look for the computer nerds, what we call the pajama Hadeen, the people who use the computers from home to challenge regimes rather than suicide bombs. Websites and blogs have become the 21st century chroniclers of police crackdowns and human rights abuses and election irregularities. I'm not the only one looking for them. So are government security forces. Many of them have gone to jail. On my travels, I met a brave Egyptian blogger. His blog has repeatedly posted cell phone videos captured in unexpected places, including one of a detainee in police custody who was being sodomized with the end of a broomstick. He put this on his blog, forcing the government to prosecute two of its own police in a place like Egypt that's unheard of. His blog today gets over 30,000 hits a day, 45,000 hits on a day of a crisis. This circumvents the state control of the media. The YouTube generation, the Facebook generation, have created a whole new political class in the Middle East. Today, there are over 1,000 blogs just in Egypt. The issue in the Middle East is no longer whether to engage in change and political transformation. The issue today is how to get there. Pressure is mounting on virtually every Middle East regime. Even the conservative Gulf sheikhdoms have had to respond, not willingly, and often with the smallest steps. But Saudi Arabia, for example, held its first male-only election in 2005. Kuwait's parliament in 2006 ended a long-standing boycott and granted women not only the right to vote, but also to run for office. What makes this era different is that the activists are now trying to hold the governments to account, and they are no longer limited to intellectuals and elites. The numbers engaged are really very striking, especially when compared to the very small cells of suicide bombers. I lived in Lebanon for 5 years in the 1980s, when violence was the chief means of expressing anything, even in traffic jams. I was always struck whenever we got stuck in traffic, someone would just pull out a gun, fire into the air, and everyone went in every different direction, and suddenly a gridlock was broken. But when I went back in 2005, Lebanon was a different place. Roughly one quarter of the population took to the streets peacefully to demand the government's resignation and also to call for Syria to end its 29-year occupation. Other countries have had similar experiences. In Jordan, more than 100,000 people turned out after the suicide bombers simultaneously struck at three downtown hotels in Amman. "Burn in hell," they shouted against al-Qaeda as they marched through the streets. And these were not rent-a-crowds. These were people who were genuinely motivated to get out and participate. Throughout the Islamic world, more than 2,000 Muslim intellectuals have signed a petition calling on the United Nations to sponsor a new treaty that would outlaw the use of religion to incite violence. They propose that the UN create an international tribunal to try what they call the theologians of terror and the sheikhs of death, who provide religious cover for terrorism. Sometimes we can see change through the human experience. What I did when I went back to the region for this new book was to try to identify people who are doing things, who are the agents of change, the catalysts of change. And I thought it might be interesting to tell you about a few of them. In Syria, I met a man named Riyad Turk. Riyad Turk is the Nelson Mandela of Syria. This is a man who has been imprisoned 4 times. The third time he was picked up, he was 50 years old. His wife was picked up at the same time. They had 2 children. He had no idea what happened to the three of them. He was held in a room with no window, underground, no furniture, no toilet. He had no pen, no paper, no newspaper, no book. He had nothing to do. The room was about the size of an elevator shaft, a little bit longer than the length of his body. No bed. He was never tried. He was never charged. He never knew what was going to happen to him. For 18 years. He came out in 1998, and what did he do? He turned around at the age of 68, his children having grown up while he was gone, and he started to lash out at the government again. In 2001, he was picked up yet again for calling on the regime to shift from autocracy to democracy. He charged publicly, broadcast on Al Jazeera, of all things, called the regime terrorists. He came out just before I was in Damascus in 2006, and I was struck by the fact that he was still at it. He was 75 years old, and he was still calling, lashing out at the government and the ruling Assad family. I'm waiting for news that he has again gone back to prison. In Egypt, I met a woman named Gada Shahbendour. Now, Gada had never voted in her life, never joined a party, never been interested in politics. She was the mother of four athletic teenagers. I think she's a typical soccer mom. She was in the middle of a divorce, going back to school so that she would be able to teach, that she could earn money. And one day on one of the new satellite television stations, again, that circumvent government control, provide an alternative vision, she saw pictures of women protesters in Cairo who were being beaten by a group of thugs as the police stood right there watching. She was furious. So Gada, a week later, went to her first protest. And she told me the delicious story of the woman next to her who didn't recognize her and said, "You must be new. Do you have 100 Egyptian pounds?" And Gada said to her, "Why?" And the woman said, "That's what you need for bail money." Well, Gada didn't flinch, and she began to mobilize her friends. And they tried to think of what they could do to make a difference. And they formed something called We're Watching You. And the U is the Egyptian government. And Gada and her friends decided with the presidential elections and followed closely after by the parliamentary elections that they would try to monitor the elections. International observers had been barred. So they went to lawyers to try to figure out what were the signs of fraud and what could they tell people to watch for. They launched a campaign. They started their own website. By word of mouth, they sent out to everyone they knew, "This is what people should watch for. Call one of these two cell phone numbers if you see anything suspicious on election day." And they barred a room in an office of a friend, and they got there the morning of the election and wondered if they were going to get a single call. By the end of the day, they had over 1,000 verifiable, detailed accounts of election fraud. They became the barometer for the media, for foreign embassies, to judge what kind of abuses had gone on. The parliamentary elections were a few months later. This time they hired a cameraman. In Egypt, one of the favorite tricks of the ruling party is that they bus in their voters in the morning to vote early. And then afterwards, the police get out and they make it difficult for others to vote. They slow down the process, and so forth. Well, there were one group of voters who were so determined to vote that they got a ladder when the police blocked the entranceway to climb over the school fence to get into the polling station and vote. The police then started firing tear gas at them, and they had a cameraman, and they caught it all on videotape. There could be no questions about what happened. Gada has since gone on, and she is now invited to help monitor elections in other parts of the Arab world. She started a program called Kidmocracy that they try to teach students about what constitutions are. And the last time I saw her last year, she'd brought the winners to Washington. In Morocco, I met a wonderful woman named Fatima Mernissi. Fatima was born in a harem. Not the concubine harem, but in the harem, the family harem, where women are often in the second and third floors. The men have the first, where there was a full-time guard who prevented women from leaving the house and from strangers from getting in. She grew up, her mother was illiterate, and she, the father even locked up the radio when the men left the house so the women couldn't hear it. Well, she was always a curious little thing, and so she watched her father once secretly and saw where the key was, and she went in, opened the cabinet when he was gone, and she would turn on the radio. And she became very curious about the outside world. At a very young age, just a few years after Morocco started public schools for girls, she begged her mother to please let her go to school. And her mother, who was a great champion of her daughter, convinced her father to at least hold a family council. And they brought all the male members of the family together to decide, could this little girl go to school? Great debate. They finally said, okay. She went to public school. And then she wanted to go to high school. At every stage, there was a family council. Well, she ended up at the Sorbonne, and then she went to Brandeis for graduate school. And she is today the Arab world's leading feminist. Another one of my favorite people is a philosopher in Iran, an early revolutionary who turned against the revolution. Many people refer to him as the Martin Luther of Islam. He is spending enormous amount of his life devoting to the kind of debates over how you merge Islam and democracy. Islam literally means submission, as in submit your will to God. And he has written extensively in ways that are accessible to the ordinary Muslim. He says, for example, to be a true believer, you have to come to your religion of your own free will. You may have inherited your faith from your family, from your community, from your country, your environment, but for you to be a true believer, you have to embrace it of your own free will. And therefore, freedom precedes religion. A radical revolutionary idea in the Islamic world. When you think about what we went through in Western civilization with the Christian Reformation giving birth to the Age of Enlightenment and the birth of modern democracy, the Islamic world is struggling right now to do all of that at the same time. The birth of democracy, I say as a woman, is still a process playing out. And the Islamic world, 400 years later, and the Islamic world is trying to crash and do it all at the same time. Another of my favorite characters I write about is a man named Hadi Khamenei. He's a cleric in Iran. He has stormed the country, arguing that there is no place in Iranian government for a supreme leader. In Iran, the supreme leader has position above the president. He has veto power over legislation, over candidates for office, over presidential actions. He has the final word on literally everything. And Hadi has stormed the country. He started a newspaper that was one of his champion causes in editorials. He argued that no one should be above the rule of law, including the supreme leader. He's paid an enormous price. He tried to run for office, was disqualified. His newspaper was banned. When he went out to give speeches, he was often roughed up by thugs, religious vigilantes. What makes him most interesting is that his older brother is Iran's supreme leader. The fact that you have diversity, even within a family, there is no longer a single truth, a single way. Diversity is a concept that is beginning to be embraced in the last block of countries to hold out against the democratic tide. Now let me also do a reality check. My title is Dreams and Shadows. And there are lots of dangers, the shadows, that are also visible. Democracy is about differences. And as we've learned in Iraq, they are bound to flourish once disparate sides of society are really free to, for the first time, to speak and make their own demands. In a region that is rife with minorities, opening up politics endangers deepening the problems it is meant to solve. Again, Iraq. Democracy can unleash existential dilemmas. Opening space also does not guarantee who or what will fill it. as we saw in the case of the Palestinian elections with the election of Hamas. And I was there for those elections. Because the Middle East is grounded in its own experience, the face of change is likely to be as well. More often than not, Islam is going to be an idiom of opposition and change. Indeed, the region may not be transformed without tapping in to its religious traditions because of the appeal and the legitimacy, but also by default. One of the great problems is, during this period of change, the ruling regimes, and there is not a single regime in the Middle East that is in sync with its people. They have outlawed, exiled, put under house arrest, in some cases executed, the democratic activists. And this has left often the, whether it's religious institutions or Islamic parties, as the main vehicle for expressing dissent. Islam is also the only major monotheistic religion that has a precise set of rules by which to govern society, as well as a set of spiritual beliefs. I think the period ahead is likely to witness an uneven contest between what I call the three crats, the democrats, the autocrats, and the theocrats. It will pit the inexperienced democrats, who have very limited resources and are under enormous pressure from regimes, against the well-heeled autocrats who have no intention of ceding power, and Islamists or the theocrats who believe they have a mission from God and they can tap into a flock of the faithful. It is going to be an unfair battle from the start. Nothing will happen quickly either. Even regimes that acknowledge the need for change talk about gradual steps, in phases, over years, in decades, in generations. For a long while, I think change may look more like participatory despotism than democracy. A former Jordanian foreign minister said to me, "Change is a future notion. The trick is putting it in the present." All the factors contributing to change will also make the region susceptible, I think, to greater turmoil and divisions in the short term, during the transition. It's going to be an extremely bumpy ride. The danger is the longer you wait, the greater the bumps. The stimulants of change also pose hazards. A major engine of change is youth. The Middle East has witnessed a sevenfold increase in its population over the past three generations, from 60 million in the 1930s to 415 million today. The majority today are young. In some countries, up to 70% of the population is under 30. They are hungry for change. They are going, in many cases, to be the agents of change. And they are willing to act politically, and numbers are on their side. Yet, as governments are increasingly unable to house them, clothe them, educate them, today's frustrated youth are also going to be looking for faster answers. Across the region, roughly one out of three young people is unemployed. It's the highest youth unemployment rate in the world. It also provides an exploitable flashpoint to build sympathy for extremist movements. Change and its agents, in some cases, will produce troubling consequences. Many in the region will question whether the short-term dangers and the short-term turbulence are worth the eventual benefits. We see this particularly coming as a result of Iraq, where people see what's happened there in the way of change and think that it's that the cost isn't worth the benefit or the price paid along the way. How much time do I have? I don't have much time. I want to open it up to your questions, so let me close and with one final thought. I think the Middle East will unquestionably continue to be the place that spurs anxiety and threatens security and drains resources. Not always by choice. It will rivet the world more than any other region for the rest of my life. Yet even as the war in Iraq has dragged on and the United States has been discredited in its promotion of democracy in the region, the majority of people in the Middle East still want the kind of political change that has happened elsewhere in the world. They are fully aware of the demise of communism in Eastern Europe, the end of military dictatorships in Latin America, the collapse of apartheid and minority rule in Africa. After my travels, I concluded that what is most inspiring is not what dreams the outside world has for the people of the Middle East. It is instead the aspirations and the goals that so many have genuinely set for themselves and begun often at great personal risk to act on themselves. Thank you very much. There's one here. And I'm told to ask you to wait for the mic, which is on its way.
Ms. Wright, could you, thank you for the glimmer of hope for the Middle East. Could you contrast what you've just described against the fighting between the Luau and the Kikuyu in East Africa, where there has been a tradition of democracy for something like 50 years, 40 years. And it seems that that in Kenya, the process you're talking about did develop and did evolve, and now it seems to be imploding upon itself. So could you give just a quick contrast of how you see the Middle East different, perhaps, than Kenya?
It's a good question. I spent 7 years of my life in Africa, and remember many of the years when Kenya and the Ivory Coast were the two great examples of democracy in the region, or stable government anyway, and of course neither one of them, both of them have had serious troubles. You know, a lot of it has to do with institutions, with education, and it's hard to compare the Middle East with Africa. Africa has its own sets of problems, and one of the great tragedies in Africa is that its first real generation of educated people has died of AIDS in huge numbers, leaving behind large numbers of orphans, has, you know, drained society in terms of where they put their resources. The developed world has not done well by Africa, and we've, you know, poured money into places like Iraq at the expense of other places that also need development, need access to education. Any society where there's poverty, there is the greater danger of strife, because survival is literally a daily battle. Yes, ma'am.
Would you comment on the effects of tribalism in Iraq?
The effects of tribalism in Iraq. Good question. I mean, one of the things we see throughout the region is the getting beyond the past, and the past is defined by traditional powers in the tribes, in the clans. We were not very knowledgeable about power structures when we went into Iraq. We were incredibly naive on so many counts. I think what the luckiest break we've had is the fact that tribal leaders in among the Sunnis, particularly in Anbar province, which is the most volatile, got fed up with al-Qaeda themselves. A young sheikh named Sattar, whose father and two brothers were killed by al-Qaeda, mobilized his fellow tribal elders, and they formed the First Awakening Council, which has been instrumental in building a genuine Sunni police force, a military force willing to take on al-Qaeda, willing to even talk to the United States, not because they like us, but because we have a common enemy. The tragedy of Iraq is that Sheikh Sattar was killed by a suicide bomb. Maybe it was a roadside bomb. I can't remember. I remember the day he was killed. His brother is taken over. The problem is there are no more brothers. So tribal structures can be a problem, but we also have to learn how to tap into those traditional powers in order to help them develop legitimate. One of the most interesting things about Iraq is that to succeed as a state, they're going to have to decentralize power and allow the provinces in many cases based on tribal powers, to have access to national revenues in order to develop what they think are the most important parts of society, clinics, schools, whatever, and not have it dictated from Baghdad, and to get their fair share of resources. It's an interesting question. Yes, ma'am.
Okay, it's about a year from now. We have a new president. I'm hoping it'll be somebody who sees the need for a lot of change in the Middle East. So the new Democratic president, either he will, she will read your book and come to you and say, what do we do? How do we change the image of the U.S. in the Middle East? Or how does the U.S. help to promote the democratic activity that you talk about?
I think it will be very interesting if we have a new president. I think that will begin, that will be a new beginning. I'm often struck when I go to the region, even in places like Iran, that as critical as they can be of the U.S. government, of U.S. policy, they still have fairly warm feelings for Americans themselves. There is the capacity still to better relations. In terms of specifics, you know, I stay away from politics as much as I can. I actually get pretty bored by American politics. I think they're so petty. One of the lessons of Iraq is you can't impose change. It has to be homegrown in order to be legitimate. You have to have the agents of change be local. You can't, as we did in Iraq, rely on a group of exiles who've been there for, who haven't been in the country, in the one case of Ahmad Chalabi, on whom we relied so heavily, who hadn't been there since 1958. And we need to let the local process play out. George Bush actually gave a good speech in 2003 when he reprimanded publicly Saudi Arabia and Egypt and said the United States had made a mistake for six decades in basing its policy on stability rather than democracy. And then he did nothing about it. There was no follow-through. We continued to provide enormous aid to Hosni Mubarak, who has ruled in Egypt in a period of 6,000 years longer than anybody but two pharaohs. And he's now grooming his son to take over. This is not a man who is an ally, and yet he gets the second highest foreign aid of any government. We have never, and a lot of it military, which he uses to create security forces who then are used against his own people. When I've gone to these rallies by the local democratic groups, they're outnumbered 10 to 1 by security forces. And you wonder how much of that aid money helped train some of these guys, arm them, whatever. We need to develop a standard. We need to be true to our values. And as I said, the longer we wait, the greater the option, the greater the possibility that it's even more violent. It's not going to be an easy ride. I mean, we've seen extraordinary change in the last 30 years every place, really inspiring. But look at Russia. It still has a communist leader almost a generation after the end of the Soviet Union. Change takes a long time, and change in the Middle East is going to take longer than any place else. But it has to be legitimate, and we have to. We lost time because of Iraq. It did not help the process, I think, in the end. I think that's how history will look back on it. Yes, sir.
Islam, according to Samuel Huntington, lacks a core state in the way that Western values have the Atlantic Alliance and the European Union, the Orthodox have Russia, the Cynic have China. Islam has no such powerful core state.
The Saudis might disagree with you, but...
Well, they have to disagree with Huntington. I'm just quoting him. Their relevance and influence is based on a dwindling natural resource, a single dwindling natural resource, which one cannot imagine having the same relevance 50 years from now. There'll be very little oil, and alternative energy sources will have developed, presumably. Why won't the Middle East then simply become irrelevant?
Wouldn't that be wonderful? I've often said the one way to deal with terrorism is to develop alternative energy sources. You know, and then we don't have to be the security prop for regimes like Saudi Arabia, which with the fall of the Taliban has become the regime with the worst human rights record in the world. It's, you know, I talked about Egypt a minute ago. The Saudis, you know, history is going to look back and say, what were you thinking? You know, the President of the United States holding hands with an absolute monarch who's, in, you know, where women can't even, in a country where women can't even drive. But we do this because of oil, because of our dependence on one national national resource. I'm with you. Let's hope in sooner than 50 years that there is a that we're more responsible in terms of our energy usage and that there are alternative energy sources. We'll always have interests in the Middle East. Israel is a very close friend, and nothing will change when it comes to the importance of Israel's survival to American national interests. We made that commitment in 1948, and that's not going to change. So it's not like we're going to walk away from the region. But our friendship with some of the last autocratic and most autocratic regimes in the world, hopefully, will change. Yes, sir, in the back.
This is a two-part question. How do you communicate with these people? How do you communicate? And by that I mean in English, or do you know their languages? And how much of a problem do we have in Iraq with the fact that there aren't a lot of people who speak Iraq and communicate with them in their language?
Arabic. I've communicated largely in English or French. I have ironically translated between a Moroccan and a Saudi who both spoke Arabic but different dialects and couldn't understand each other. So, you know, this is a region that has enormous diversity. This is one of the stereotypes that they're, you know, Arabs, or a lot of people even think Iranians are Arabs, and of course they're not. They loathe each other by and large historically, or at least there's a huge culture clash. I mean, I've often said the clash of civilizations is within the region. You know, you get in Saudi Arabia women who are conservatively dressed behind four layers of veil, and, you know, not far away you see in Lebanon, the women wear the sexiest, sassiest bikinis, and men wear, you know, the bare bones speedos, you know, on beaches. There's a very diverse culture, very different values. I understand, when I lived in Beirut, I got to the point I understood a little bit of Arabic, not enough to have a conversation. One of the limitations in my job is all the places I've lived in the world, I picked up a lot of Italian, I picked up a lot of Portuguese in Angola and Mozambique when I lived in Africa. I knew a little bit of Zulu and Xhosa and so forth, but never enough to speak it. And they'll always say, oh, yes, yeah, by all means, you know, learn the language. And by the way, you have four deadlines tomorrow. So I would, the one thing I'd say to any young person today is learn two languages. One, a Latin language, Latin-based language, and the other, whether it's Russian, Japanese, Chinese, Arabic, another culture language. In an era of globalization, it's the most important thing. If I had my life to do over, that's what I'd do. In terms of Iraq, you know, the amazing thing is that we still have not, all this time since our intervention, we still don't have a large core, even a medium core, even a large, small core of native speakers. We have not learned the basic lesson, and we have to rely on locals. And I think one of the problems is we have been, unlike Vietnam, we've been very bad about offering them, whether it's protection if they feel they're in trouble and eventual access to the United States. Last year we had only taken in, I think, something like 600 Iraqis, and we've agreed to increase it. But when you think that Syria has taken in, I think it's 1 million Iraqis. It's changed its population by something like 7%. In Jordan, they've taken in 700,000, but increased its population by 12%. It's, you know, the numbers are just huge for those little societies, and yet they're paying the price of, you know, our intervention. Language is a big deal, and one of closing, you know, the kind of clash of civilizations that Sam Huntington also wrote about depends on understanding culture. One of the things that surprises me when I talk about Islam in places is the fact that most Americans don't know that Muslims worship the same God. Allah is simply the Arabic word for the same God. They accept, embrace, believe in Abraham and Jesus, and I get Christmas cards every year from Muslims who quote about the birth of Jesus and quote about the Virgin Mary, who's considered a model for womanhood in the Islamic world, from the Quran. And they're always surprised that Americans don't understand that. And that's how deep the cultural gap is. Yes, sir.
In the communicating with those that you admire, that you spoke of earlier, meeting with these people, are you not concerned about your safety? You're seen with these people. The fact of your position, does that help protect you in your meetings with these people?
Well, I'll tell you, for the book, I told you about the hopeful characters. What I didn't tell you is about some of the shadows I met with as well, because I wanted to get a full sense of what's happening in the region. So I went to Damascus, and I saw Khalid Mashal, who's head of Hamas. In Lebanon, I went to see Hassan Nasrallah, who's head of Hezbollah. I saw the full range. I saw the emirs in the Gulf. I saw, you know, the bad guys at every level. President Ahmadinejad of Iran. I've talked to the full range of them. You know, it's a funny thing. I sometimes think if you listen, that people will not go after you. Now, I didn't go see Al-Qaeda. You know, I didn't look for Osama bin Laden. I'm not that stupid. When I went to Afghanistan during the Taliban's era, I went with my heart in my stomach, you know. I won an award years ago for exceptional courage and initiative. I was for coverage of some African wars, and my mother went to New York and accepted it for me, and she got up and told the audience how she was stunned that I'd won this award because I was so scared of things as a kid that she had to pay the neighbor boy to walk me to school until I was in the sixth grade. That hasn't changed, you know. But I actually am just very, very curious, and I feel very privileged to be able to see history as it unfolds. I grew up in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and, you know, to have access to some of the great characters of our time. I used to fly around the world with Pope John Paul II when I lived in Rome. You know, I knew Nelson Mandela. I've known, you know, the great characters of history. You know, maybe someday it'll backfire. I hope not. Sir.
Could you talk about the dreams and shadows that you see in the Middle East as it applies from the Arab world toward Israel?
As it applies to? Oh, toward Israel. Well, I think there has been an evolution. I remember in 1981 and 82, I went to two summits in Fez, Morocco, when King Fahd was first trying to get his plan accepted by the Arab League. It was the genesis of what was finally accepted in 2003 in Beirut when they said, you know, we will recognize Israel and have full relations if, you know, we go back to the 67 borders. They know they're not going to get the 67 borders, but they're not going to say, oh, right, and we'll compromise on everything. So I think there has been an evolution, not enough. I think there's, you know, I think the peace process today is going no place under the Bush administration. I think Annapolis did not get us anywhere. I think I've traveled with secretaries of state dating back to Henry Kissinger. And I think Condoleezza Rice has no ability to follow through. That's right, there have been some Democrats who haven't been able to follow through either. But it's just a tragic moment when, you know, there is, you know, Yasser Arafat has been removed from the scene, and there were opportunities. I ultimately believe there will be a peaceful solution. I don't think we're there yet, but I do think the Arabs have moved. I think both sides have to move a little bit more to make it work. Yes, sir.
The Persian Gulf countries, like the United Arab Emirates, seem so peaceful, capitalist, tranquil. Why are they different from the rest of the Arab region?
Why are the Gulf states? Well, you know, it helps when you have money. I mean, you know, you look at the Persian Gulf, the Arabian Peninsula countries, and there again you have diversity. You have little Qatar, which is now where our central command is headquartered. It's a little island off the thumb off Saudi Arabia, where the per capita income is now over $38,000 a year. And just a few hundred miles down the peninsula, you have Yemen, where the per capita income is $500 a year. It's not all wealthy. They've been basically able to buy their citizenry, you know, providing whether it's free education or health care. And yet what's really interesting is that there are still activists within their society pressing for more. The women who go out and demand, who are petitioning to drive, doesn't seem like much. But when you open, as we know, you open a crack in the door and it's almost impossible to close. It may take a long time to open completely. I went to the Gulf countries, but I found that the kind of dynamics of change, the tension of change, was not visible there in large enough doses, in part because oil wealth and democracy promotion are often incompatible. This is why it may take longer to get there than it will in other parts of the region. I guess that's the best answer I can give you. Yes, sir.
Earlier you mentioned the three crats, the theocrats, the autocrats, and the democrats. It seems like the theocrats and autocrats tend to view the Israel-Palestine situation as like a central injustice that's been inflicted and is a powerful organizing tool for them. But what about the democrats? How do they tend to view that conflict, and is it a powerful organizing tool for them?
They differ, but it also isn't uniform. You know, you think that the theocrats are opposed to Israel's existence. And what's interesting is for a long time, despite the angry rhetoric out of Iran, for the Persians, who are not Arabs, the Palestinian issue was one to speak about, but they didn't really care. It's not something that galvanizes the Persian imagination. In a place like, that doesn't prevent Ahmadinejad from saying stupid things about the Holocaust, but unbelievable things, in fact. I mean, but then in Morocco, there's a party called the Party of Justice and Development, which is a mildly Islamist party. They like to compare themselves to the Christian Democrats in Europe, willing to recognize Israel's right to exist. The leader will talk openly about it, believes that Moroccan Jews should have an important part in Moroccan society. So so it's not always automatic. The irony also is that some of our closest allies in looking for democracy are the very people we once were most concerned about in the Middle East, and that's the old Marxists, many of them reform Marxists, who are now the most active secular, in many countries, activists when it comes to penning criticism, condemning the regime, mobilizing declarations that have set out goals for change. The agents are vary in so many ways that there's no formula to be able to apply to any set of them. Many of many of the secular parties are leftists or the old Marxists who now say, we're former Marxists who just want to create political space. You know. One more? Yes?
Could you play an imagine game and imagine what the Middle East would look like now, if any change at all, if the United States had not intervened in the war?
You know, that's a great question, and I wish I could give you an answer that I really believed in. I think that we would not have the turmoil. We'd still have Saddam Hussein there. But we also had a mechanism in place. I think our greatest mistake with Iraq was we steamrolled into Iraq, and we didn't let the process through the United Nations play out. We had the weapons inspectors back in there for only a matter of weeks. I mean, they'd spent 8 years there before. We would have gotten the international community more on board if Saddam again had stalled. And we might have gotten Turkey eventually on board so that we could have used the northern border and we could have sent in from both sides. I mean, I still think that we were so ignorant of Iraq that there was almost no formula that would make it kind of a winnable the way we played it. We needed more forces. I mean, we would have had to do it so differently. But there are also ways that politically we could have won more parties to be players and put pressure on Saddam, perhaps to slowly cooperate with us. I mean, what an amazing fact that he bluffed when he had nothing. It's just astounding. And I was one of those who believed that he might have had weapons because I covered the Iran-Iraq war and I saw the victims of his use of chemical weapons against the Iranians. You know, and I went back, in fact, to Iran in 2002 on the eve, you know, just months before the invasion to look at what happened to their victims of chemical weapons because we were so fearful that they might use them against American troops and were there any lessons and so forth. And 15 years since the end of the Iran-Iraq war, the numbers of those who died because there's something called low-dose exposure, many people didn't get the symptoms for years, has doubled. They've lost 100,000 people just from Saddam's use of chemical weapons. So there was no question that this was a man capable of using the deadliest arms against his enemy as well as his own people. But it was a tremendously unwise war. And the question only history will be able to answer was, you know, was it something that we shouldn't have done that ended up costing us more? I suspect that we'll say yes. I thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.